Tech Talk with Matthew Dickerson. Matthew Dickerson. Tech Talk. Sit back and relax. It's time to talk technology.
Hello, jet setters, and welcome to another high-flying, globe-trotting episode of Tech Talk with Matthew Dickerson. Today, above all days, we're leaning heavily into the age of information and technology, and to tell you all about that, I'm going to throw long distance to Matthew Dickerson all the way over in South Korea, of all places. Come in, Matthew. Are you there?
Are you there, James? Are you there?
Yes, we're there. Yes, we're there together.
We've done a whole range of different locations where we've recorded Tech Talk over the years. Obviously, COVID necessitated all sorts of strange things. I remember we did one walk along the riverside one time when you couldn't visit someone in your house, but you could go for a walk. But I'm not sure that I can remember ever doing one before when one of us has been overseas. So I think this is the first, James.
There's been a couple of times we've had to reschedule because of visiting journeys all over the place. But we're using modern technology like it's supposed to be used.
So hopefully the quality is coming through just as good for everyone. And I'm happy to tell you that I won't take a toilet break through the episode because I've taken multiple toilet breaks in my trip to South Korea so far because I just love playing with the toilets, James. I'm not sure when we're going to find...
You love a good toilet. Well, don't we all?
I'm not sure when we're going to finally get to the stage where we get toilets like we have, and lots of places have them. South Korea has them. Japan has them. So many controls on the toilet. We've had a couple of embarrassing situations. One was I actually went and visited a friend in South Korea, and this was at her house, and went to the toilet, and I was looking at the control panel written in Korean, didn't have my phone with me, so I couldn't translate, and I'm pressing various buttons standing beside the toilet, and before I knew it, the bidet stuck out and started squirting the wall on the other side of the bathroom.
That brings a giggle.
Well, when you have to explain to your friend that the water all over the wall and on the ground was not from me, but was from the toilet.
Sounds like the sort of thing Frank Spencer might have done in the early 70s.
That's right. And then the other one I had was there was a different one. This was in a motel room where the actual control panel could be removed from the toilet. And I just had these visions of my kids, maybe my wife playing tricks on me, sitting out in the main area of the motel room using the control panel while I'm sitting on the toilet. And I try to work out, why would I possibly need a remote control for my toilet? Because presumably the place that you want to use the remote, the toilet control, is when you're on the toilet, not when you're out in the lounge room. So I couldn't quite work out why I could remove that and move around with it. But
Maybe it's for those relatives who just refuse to clean up properly.
So you let them go in with the remote control.
So you take control out of their hands and do it for them.
That sounds really
the abstainers, the conscientious, the toilet paper conscientious objectors.
That's the one. So I do like the toilet. So I like to get more electronics in my life, and surely getting electronics in the bathroom is a fantastic idea. So I do like those toilets, but I do like the technology you see in different places. It's not always better technology than Australia, but it's just different technology. So anyway, we'll continue on. Enough toilet talk. I'll let you continue on.
So more knickknacks for the Dickerson household, I guess.
Oh, I'm tempted, James. I'm tempted.
All right, enough of this toilet talk. Let's get stuck right into today's story, shall we?
Sure.
Now, we all know by now not to go diving onto the internet for a quick amateur self-diagnosis of our illness. That's because we know that there are people who are actually trained specifically for this job, and they're called doctors. And it's safer to spend your time with them than on Google. But what about post-diagnosis, folks? In the treatment phase, I mean. Matt, AI doctors are still a way off, but AI nurses, well, there's some potential there.
And I don't want to downplay the importance of nurses, James. Nurses play an incredibly important role in our health system. But one of the issues we see at the moment across the world is there's definitely a shortage of nurses, but in particular in aged care facilities. Our health system has been so good across the world that we're all living longer, which is fantastic. We've increased the age that we live to from 100 years ago, from maybe 50 being the median age, to maybe getting closer to 80 now. So that's fantastic, but we've got all these old people that someone needs to look after. there's a few issues here, and I did some research in the US in particular, and the average hourly wage for a registered nurse in the US is $38.74 per hour, but still at that rate, you can't get enough of them. So now we're talking about AI nurse bots, and that's exactly what we're seeing in use in the real world in some aged care facilities. Now, it's not a robot that walks in and starts trying to diagnose what's going on. They're a voice-based chatbot, and essentially they're on a computer, on an iPad, that type of thing. So you'll have a conversation with them, and exactly as you said, post-operative care or medication instructions. And I've got a couple of friends that are nurses in aged care facilities, and they say one of the more frustrating things that they find with some of their patients, some of their clients, is the forgetting of medication. And you've probably seen those plastic pill boxes that have got all the right pills on all the right days. And that's fantastic as long as people remember to actually go to their pill box in the first place. So that's apparently a big issue. The people have got the pill box in the toilet or in the bathroom and they just don't go and look at it. So having someone,
I can sympathize with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Remembering to take tablets is a big thing.
It is a big thing, that's right. And when you've got to take them every day and there's maybe different ones for different days. So having a nurse bot that can say, James, are you taking your medication today? Yep, I better go and do that. Or how are you feeling? So you've just had an operation, you've had some treatment, whatever it might be that you've had, and then you get a voice-based chatbot, a nurse bot, having a conversation with you to find out how you're feeling. Now, obviously, a part of this whole process is as soon as anything untoward, anything where you're not feeling good or anything's not working correctly, that's when the nurse bot can call in the cavalry and say, let's get some real people in there, let's get some real nurses, some real doctors, whatever it might be. But essentially, at this stage, the accuracy and the bedside manner, people are reasonably happy. They had a survey of 5,500 healthcare professionals that were involved with the beta testing, and they said, in general, they were satisfied with AI. I do actually like the name of it. It's called Hippocratic AI, obviously based on the Hippocratic Oath. And I'm assuming they are doing no harm in this scenario. But this is all to address this shortage we're seeing. And the estimation is that across the world, by the year 2030, there'll be a shortage of 15 million healthcare workers. So kids out there, if you want to know an industry to get into, then healthcare is obviously not a bad industry to get into. So essentially, we're talking about nurse bots replacing nurses, or not replacing, but supplementing nurses.
Sorry, yeah. Yeah, supplementing. We're not. No one's going to be losing their job over this. This is just a bit of support to help out.
It is, that's right. And I think that's where a lot of people are talking about AI, the aim to complement rather than replace human workers in whatever the industry might be, and obviously in this industry in particular, just complementing those and still having the professionals on hand to help out if they can. Mm. So it's all going well so far. One of the things I did like about it is that they've got an empathy inference engine as part of the Hippocratic AI. So I think that just means it says things that make you feel okay about yourself. But in essence, it's a way that we're going forward, James, and I don't see this slowing down anytime soon.
Amazing stuff. Seven weeks ago, we brought you news of the first implanted Neuralink brain chip designed to bring a closer connection between man and machine. Well, the subject of the first implant now has had over a month of experiences to share, and the training wheels may still be on, but he's learned some cool new tricks, Matt.
Cool new tricks indeed. Playing chess with your mind. Now, I actually had a bit of a think about this, and I'll talk about it in more detail. The problem here, I thought, is I've got to think about my next move in chess while I've got to think about moving in chess. So it adds an extra complication to the whole process. I think Nolan is his name. Nolan should be given some extra time on a chess move when he's got to have his play because of this extra complication. Now, it sounds pretty complicated playing chess with your mind. So my first thought was, wow, this Neuralink, he's only had it, as you said, for 5 or 6 weeks, and already he's able to just think about, okay, move the bishop, move the king. But it's not quite as good as it sounds initially, because what he's doing is he's playing computer chess, and what he's doing is he's controlling a cursor. And so they've then applied that to playing a game of chess. So in other words, he's only got to think about moving the cursor up or down or left or right, which sounds to me a lot simpler for something to interpret your brain waves when you've only really got four dimensions to move in, four movements to make, up, down, left, right, rather than, this is an interesting move now. Should I move my pawn on this go or what should I do? That sounds a lot more complicated, but I'm still, don't get me wrong, I'm still impressed.
And you don't have the computer to hear your what you're thinking about planning ahead either, do you? Because you're making your plans a couple of pieces down the track.
Well, it might start moving them as well. You might be going, I'm thinking about moving my pawn. No, don't move my pawn. I'm only thinking about, that's it, my game, my go's over.
Too bad.
That's right. So I do find this fascinating. I thought it would have taken a lot longer for them to get to the point where they're basically trying to interpret. It's like learning a new language. They're trying to interpret, when I see this brain wave, what is Nolan thinking about? Now, again, if I'm only thinking about up, down, left, right, that's one thing. But when you start to think about, yes, I'd like to move into the left lane with my car and accelerate to 60 kilometres an hour, wow, are they going to get to the stage where it's that accurate? And I suppose that's a big part of all of this process, that we don't really know where we're going with it. We've seen for a long time that we can read brain waves. There's some external pulse that's put out by the brain when we're doing things, but to actually interpret that, to get to the level of accuracy that we can interpret it to work out what we're actually thinking, that sounds quite incredible. He's talked about a few different things. Nolan Arbour is his name. So Nolan's talked about a few different things. He's playing Civilization 6. That was apparently a favourite game of his because he's been paralysed below the shoulder after a diving accident, was how he ended up being part of this whole experimental process with Neuralink. So he's playing Civilization 6 again. He did an 8-hour session after the implant. And he says himself that the technology's not perfect yet, but again, I wouldn't expect it to be. This is the first person, remember, the first person in the world that's had some sort of chip installed in their brain. So I'd be very surprised if it was perfect from day one. Now, there was a bit of an issue, though, last month. Issues were reported with Neuralink's record keeping and quality controls on their animal experiments, remembering that we did talk last time we spoke about this, that the FDA had finally given permission for Neuralink to start doing tests on humans, but maybe they'll rethink that after they look at their record keeping and quality controls. Maybe Elon sounds like something out of some of these scary movies we see where they just ignore all the protocols and just go full steam ahead because they know they've got the solution, and then maybe some of the protocols are a good idea. So I'm not accusing Elon of that, of course. I would never do that, but maybe that's something that they need to think about. But I just think if we get to the stage where this works, things like people that are paralyzed, again, Nolan's a perfect example, medical rehabilitation. I've seen people that have had strokes and they can't speak properly, but you know their mind's active and they're thinking lots of things. You can see it in their eyes, but they can't quite communicate that. Imagine being able to sit down and have a conversation via a computer with someone that can't speak any longer, but their brain's still quite active. So think about Stephen Hawking. I mean, some of the wonderful things Stephen Hawking did, and his body wasn't a fantastic body, but his brain obviously was. So I think there's lots of potential here. Playing chess, step one, step two, who knows what we're going to see next?
Yeah, wow, this is an amazing space to watch. In computing over the past 80 years since ENIAC performed its first crude calculations, but there is still yet to develop a computer like our very own brains. Sure, there are machines on Earth that have superior processing power and storage capacity now, but at least there are none that can do it on such a low voltage. Energy efficient computing is the new holy grail in the tech world, Matt, and here we go.
Well, it's interesting, James. We don't really understand how the human brain works. There's been obviously a lot of research done, but how we store things, how we remember things, I think we understand that the way to remember things is through repetition, and that's one thing that computers certainly have over humans. They can remember things, they can store that memory of things for a long period of time, but we as humans, we're not actually that good at remembering stuff from a long time ago. And even though people say to me sometimes, oh, I remember in kindergarten this thing happened, they're not really remembering back to kindergarten. What they're really remembering is in kindergarten something happened and it was so significant that they talked about it a year later and they talked about it a year later and they talked about it a year later. So they're actually remembering the last time they talked about it more so than remembering way back to kindergarten. But there's this whole area of computing called neuromorphic computing. And that's an approach to computing that's inspired by the structure and function of the human brain. Most of the work we're doing in neuromorphic computing is theoretical at this stage, because again, we just don't understand enough about how the brain works. But you're absolutely spot on with power consumption. Data centers are huge consumers of power. And I've had that question posed to me before. Are we actually better off using computers for, say, Zoom meetings or remote video conference meetings, or all the technology that's involved in making that happen? Are we actually better off getting in a plane and flying to a meeting? I still think we're better off using computers, but we do use a lot of power. So if we could get low power consumption, like the human brain, we don't use a lot of power. Some of my friends use a lot less power than other people. But if we could get at the stage where we're using low power consumption, and that adaptability of the human brain and the processing capabilities. And that's one thing that computers haven't got. The creativity, the ability to take separate pieces of information and put them together. Researchers at Tohoku University have developed a theoretical model for spin wave reservoir computing. And this is all about using a reservoir computing, which involves a fixed randomly generated network known as a reservoir for memorizing and transforming past input. It sounds incredibly complicated. Again, they aren't producing this yet. They're really just talking about this in a theoretical concept. But if they can get this right, then it will actually be a bit like quantum computing. It will change the way we think about computing, change the way we think about storage of data, but also interpretation of data. I think that's one thing humans do much better than computers, is we look at data and we interpret that in different ways, whereas computers aren't really great at interpreting that data. But I think if this could get somewhere or get some traction, I think in 10 years' time, we will see computers in a completely different light. And building on the back of AI, this is a scary but also incredibly exciting field.
Amazing things happen here. Yeah, just absolutely incredible. And I think there's a lot to wrap your head around there. So, another one to a very interesting space to watch for the future. For many people, perhaps even most people, the name Fukushima is primarily regarded as a nuclear wasteland. And it's probably fair enough. People opposed to nuclear power generators, the Fukushima tragedy reinvigorated an argument that had been languishing from Chernobyl for a quarter of a century prior. The cleanup of the source, the plant itself, it could take up to 40 years, optimistically, and the area won't be inhabitable for at least another century. A big part of the problem is just getting in there to survey the damage. But is there a situation here now where drone technology can be a major advantage, Matt?
Absolutely right. And we are going back 2011, so we're talking about 13 years ago. Yeah. But people still hear the name Fukushima and they know, or their first thought, I imagine for most people, is the nuclear power plant disaster there. I think it was a magnitude 9 earthquake and then a tsunami that caused the meltdown. The three reactors, number one reactor was obviously the most severely damaged. So what do we do about this? Well, we've seen a whole range of things that have occurred, covering it up and containing that radiation. But you can't just leave it like that. You've got to at some stage go through and clean up what's there. The Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings, TEPCO, have started using miniature drones to go in. Not surprisingly, it's a bit hard for them to get volunteers to go in and actually have a look around and see how it all looks. But they've been able to generate some drones that can go in and have a look. And they've got two. They've got small flying drones, but they've also got a snake-like bot that they've been sending in and having a look in the primary containment vessel. Now, they're basically going and getting footage at this stage. So, for example, they had one drone go in over a two-day period and capture footage of the internal conditions, the control rod drive mechanism. It saw extensive damage in there, obviously. And you've got a whole range of molten nuclear fuel mixed with the surrounding devices. I haven't seen the footage yet. I'd be fascinated to see the footage and see exactly what it looks like inside there. But it's a pretty difficult job to clean it up. But without knowing what it looks like, it's an even harder job to clean it up. So they're sending these drones in and these snake-like bots to have a look at that. I was actually interested to see just how much radiation there was in there, but the drones have actually not been measuring radiation levels because they're trying to stay as lightweight and maneuverable as possible. They want the battery life to last as long as possible. So they haven't worried about putting any devices on there to actually measure the radiation. So dosimeters, what's the correct pronunciation for those?
You're asking the wrong guy. I'm going to say dosimeter.
Yeah, dosimeter sounds good to me. So essentially they haven't had those on there. Obviously they could send them in with dosimeters on there to look at that radiation level. But in general, they just want to see what it looks like in there. I'm probably just as interested to see the footage as I am to see what their next step is. What do they do once they see this footage? Because at some point, they've got to work out how they're going to take care of all this. Do they move it all away? Do they pour a bunch of concrete over the top of it? I don't know what the answer is. I suppose this is the point of this. They don't know what the answer is either. And they are using drones to look at what's there to see what their next step is, what their plan of attack is. But drones are used for so many things, so many good examples of drone usage. We see drones used in warfare as well, which is not so great a usage of a drone. But seeing drones used in this particular way, it's hard to imagine another device that they could get in there and look around in the same way a drone could to see what they've got to do about this issue.
Collect massive amount of data for NASA so we can learn more about the source of all our power. They've been asked to download an app and point their cameras at the sun during a solar eclipse this month. Now, Matt, what's with all this hubbub?
It does sound like a lot of fun. In fact, I've been speaking to my brother who lives in America, and he's gotten that keen about this particular total solar eclipse that he's booked a couple of... He's into it. He's actually booked a couple of motels. Where he lives is not exactly under the path of the, or the totality, if you like, of the total solar eclipse. So he's gone and booked some motels in the path, and then the day beforehand, he's going to, and he got ones that he could cancel without penalty 24 hours beforehand, he's going to look at the actual weather forecast for the different spots where he's booked motels and then choose the one that's got the best weather forecast and then go to that one. Now, keen listeners in the US that download this podcast, as soon as it comes out, this will be applicable to them because April 8th is when this total solar eclipse is. And this podcast comes out, of course, on April 8th. So go and do it and have a look at it. But we get to be excited about a total solar eclipse. But in reality, one occurs across the planet somewhere about every 18 months. So as much as we go, oh, wow, this is really cool, but we think it's not that common. But if you pick a particular spot on Earth, so somewhere in the US, for example, then about once every 400 years you see it, which is why we think it's actually pretty rare. There was the Great American Eclipse back in 2017. It went for 2 minutes and 40 seconds. This one that's going to happen on the 8th of April will go for 4 minutes and 28 seconds. It's a different path to the last solar eclipse. But again, it's pretty significant and lots of people in America. So NASA have said, let's use those keen citizen scientists out there like my brother and let's go and gather a whole bunch of data. Now, in the next week, James...
Crusoe, by the way, either.
He is not.
Quite a few people.
Absolutely right. Really
interested in taking photographs of the sun. I'm surprised to find that out. But I actually know a couple of people who are very interested in taking photos of the sun myself. Yeah.
And here's a challenge for us all. Over the next week, I want our listeners to try and use the word oblate in general conversation because that's exactly what this is all about. They're measuring the sun's oblateness, which effectively is how elliptical the sun is, if you like, to be a bit more boring with a word that people are more familiar with. Obviously, we think the sun and we think the Earth are basically spherical, but they're not quite because of the spin of the Earth and the spin of the sun. And what they're actually asking people to do is give up what you've just talked about, taking photos. Most people have got maybe a couple of phones, so maybe they can still take photos with one of their other phones, but download the Sun Sketcher app, then point it at the sun during the total solar eclipse, use the app to effectively record the sun, and then buy all of these different images they'll receive via this app, and they'll all have a timestamp and a geolocation stamp on those images they will then be able to get a better read on the oblateness of the sun. And what I loved about this is that even NASA, it is, even NASA, with the budget that NASA has, I don't know any single agency in the US that would have the manpower or the money to go and get all these different images that you could get by using citizen scientists out there. So I encourage people to listen to this to go and do it, but I don't think I need to, because I think lots of people are doing it anyway, and then they'll get all this information, add this to their database of various eclipse observations, and then basically get to the stage where they can use that information to study the sun's gravity, how that influences other planets, test gravitational theories, a whole range of things they can do with this. Now, I know you're thinking that haven't they already done this back in 2017 when the great American eclipse happened? Well, they did to a certain extent, but no surprise here, from 2017 to 2024, a lot more people have got smartphones, a lot more people have got better smartphones, and the camera technology on the smartphones has increased quite dramatically. So in general, yes, they had those measurements from 2017, but this will give us even better information, add to that 2017 information, and we'll get even more information about the sun. I absolutely love it.
And this is an embodiment of the whole many hands make for light work. A lot's been happening in the world of AI since it really started to hit the headlines just over a year ago. It seems that for better or for worse, the only limit for our AI is our own imaginations. And it seems that businesses and government bodies alike can either choose to embrace it or wither away to oblivion. Well, the Australian Federal Police are embracing this new tool and hoping it can make their jobs a little bit easier in fighting foreign crime rings, Matt.
Yeah, and there's a few examples I'm going to give you about how AI is being used. The UN General Assembly unanimously adopted the first global resolution on AI. That was back on the 21st of March. So you know it's pretty serious when the UN starts to get involved. But there's a few different ways that we're seeing AI used on a daily basis. Now, you mentioned one there, AFP. They believe that the efficiency of AI in a whole range of things, which I'll talk about in a moment, can be a great tool against foreign crime rings. For example, they can interpret, understand, and translate foreign texts almost instantaneously. So rather than relying on a human to look at text messages or text information, anything written down and try and interpret that, they're able to use AI to do it. And because it's not just a straight AI tool, I mean, we talked before that I'm in South Korea, I've got a translation app, but sometimes when I look at the translation and then talk to someone who actually can speak Korean and English and they tell me what my translation ended up as, it's quite comical. So we know that translation apps aren't perfect, but when you add AI into the mix, it's much better at actually working out what the person was trying to say. So again, as we talked about before, the AFP says that AI will augment but not replace human expertise, but transcribing communications and translating foreign texts is, there are a couple of areas there where AFP is really using AI as a crime-fighting tool. So I love that. AFP has also been talking to Monash University about helping detect online child abuse material. And they've been asking people to send in photos of people at different ages so that AI can learn about different ages and how old people are, so then they can better use that if they're actually trying to detect online abuse or child abuse material. Suncorp said they're using AI for insurance claims. They're using geospatial data, historical data information to more rapidly assess customer properties. I mean, some people joke that an insurance company for insurance claims AI tool would be quite easy. It would just say no all the time, because that's what insurance companies sometimes seem to do. But I think they're getting better than that, hopefully. But again, Suncorp says that we think we can get the whole process to be more pleasant if we've got AI to speed up this process. And you've got even companies like SAP, a huge organization, and they're using AI at an experimental stage at this stage to look at how businesses might be able to refine some of their workflow processes using AI. So I think you're right. I think what you said there is you either embrace AI or stand back and get knocked over by the various organizations, various businesses using that. And I think the AFP example is a perfect example. I know the crims out there are using AI. So if you're going to fight the crims, you probably need to be using a tool that's at least as good as what they're using.
Now, in the intro to the last story, I mentioned that businesses and government bodies alike will either embrace AI or perish, but that rather ominous ultimatum is highly likely to extend to anyone and everyone that needs to get any job done in the near future. Matt, is AI still just a tool that we can use, or are we rapidly getting to the point where this thing's likely to take over?
Well, I hope we're not at the takeover point yet, but continuing on with the last story about different things that are happening, I actually read this great article about a person who said, I'm going to just use AI in every aspect of my life for a two-week period. I'm just going to say, pretend AI is taking over the world. What's going to happen? How is it going to work? And one of the things that
That's this particular experiment when you make it, isn't it?
I love the idea. And one of the things that certainly was a conclusion at the end of this is that this writer said that AI will be deemed crucial for maintaining employment irrespective of one's profession. And people say, sure, I go out and I dig holes to plant trees, and how's AI going to help me? And I can't answer that today, but I'm pretty sure that at some point in time, AI is going to have an influence on every individual profession. I mean, knowledge workers.
That's right. There's things we haven't thought of yet. And someone only requires someone to think about it, or even AI to find a solution for that. We can answer that through using AI. So I can help.
Exactly.
These things are just around the corner.
Exactly right. And that's the issue, I think, that we're seeing here, is that we think we know what we're doing with AI, but we just can't imagine. We are scratching the surface at the moment. Knowledge workers, they often talk about as being the big area. 1 billion knowledge workers there are globally at the moment, and they definitely are going to be influenced by AI and how they do their job. Doing background research, thinking about different ideas for things, this whole cognitive revolution is being likened to the Industrial Revolution, automating knowledge work the same way that we automated manual labor in the Industrial Revolution, then that definitely is going to happen. McKinsey, which is a very famous consulting company, estimates that by 2030, tasks comprising up to 30% of US work hours could be automated by AI. Now, again, I don't think that means that all those people are going to lose their jobs, but I think they'll be doing different work or applying their intelligence in different ways rather than just doing some of the grunt work. And that's where I think AI can be used really well, doing some of the grunt work. This particular writer, when used AI for 2 weeks, used a bunch of different tools, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Otter, just to name a few, but there are all these different ones that are coming out. And generative AIs are getting to the stage where they're multimodal. So they're using text, using images. I've even tried creating a logo, for example. I just made up a brand name and said, create a logo for me. And bang, there was a logo that it created. I often use pictures that are created by AI for posts I put on social media. So it's quite fascinating what you can do with it. And I think at the moment it is only limited by our imagination, but maybe at some point in the future it will only be limited by AI's imagination.
Well, the news about developments in EV technology just keeps getting better and better. Of course, battery technology is always going to improve, and it has done so just lately with some nifty breakthroughs in solid-state batteries, Matt. It's got a whiff of a bit of stink about a sulfurous smell, but you've got more information for us than that.
Hopefully the smell will be contained within the battery, James. I do take your point that maybe it's a bit smelly. But we often hear talk about solid electrolytes and solid-state batteries. And essentially the concept here is if you use a solid electrolyte instead of the liquid or gel that are found in, say, current lithium-ion batteries, you can get better energy density. And that's what this is all about. We know that you could extend the range of a car quite easily. You could have a 1,000-kilometre car or a 2,000-kilometre car if you wanted to, but you keep adding lithium-ion batteries. They're very heavy, and it's all about that energy density. How many kilowatt-hours can we store per kilogram of battery? That's the real secret in amongst the developments that are happening within batteries. Solid-state batteries promise better energy density, but there have been a few issues in the past. But researchers at the University of California in San Diego have unveiled a groundbreaking cathode material for lithium sulfur batteries. And the big issue here is the enhancement of electrical conductivity. So essentially, if they can get this right, featuring a solid electrolyte, a lithium metal anode, and a sulfur cathode, they're talking not just about a small increase, James, in energy density. They're talking about doubling the energy storage per kilogram. So take some current models and think about models that many models out there now are getting 450, 500 kilometers, even 600 kilometers. Keep the weight of the car the same, and suddenly you get to 1,000, 1,200 kilometers out of a car. Gee, those people that have got their range anxiety.
Range anxiety out the window.
Yeah, exactly right. So that sounds pretty exciting. Now, again, you can't go and buy a car tomorrow that's going to have this new solid-state battery, but we're making progress there in a whole range of different ways. The other thing that this does is it actually is self-healing, which doesn't mean you can go and hit it with an axe and it's all okay, but you get expansion and contraction as you actually charge the battery and use the battery. And the low melting point of the sulfur iodide cathode allows the solid-solid interface between the cathode and the electrolyte to basically repair itself. And what that means is better longevity of the battery. So to give you an idea, the research team have done a test where they've cycled the battery 400 times and they've managed to still retain 87% of its original capacity. And when you think about that, I probably only charge my car once a week. Depends what I'm doing and how much I'm traveling, but maybe once a week I might charge my car. If I thought about that, that's effectively 8 years worth of cycles on my battery. And after 8 years, still having 87% of my original capacity sounds pretty attractive. So again, this is all about how do we keep improving the batteries and how do we get better energy density in our batteries. So people talk about solid-state batteries. Lots of people go, I'll wait till I get one of those. Well, they might have one less excuse soon, James.
Yeah, one less excuse indeed. While we're on the subject of EVs, apparently Tesla has taken a bit of a body blow in China, and so they're scaling back production just by a little bit. Matt, what's behind the downturn for Tesla?
Well, I am a Tesla fan, James, and when I saw the fact that we are. And when I saw the fact that I was scaling back from 6.5 days a week to 5 days per week, my initial thought was, oh no, what's going wrong with the EV market? All those EV haters out there, finally they've had their day. It's all over. The bubble has finally burst. But then I looked at it a bit more and I thought, well, no, actually this is a good sign. Maybe not from a Tesla devotee, but from an EV devotee, this is a good sign. There's been a 17% rise in passenger car sales in China, but a 37.5% increase in EV and new energy vehicle sales in 2024, at the beginning of 2024.
So it's just about competition then?
It's about competition. It's about more manufacturers getting in on the game. And don't get me wrong, Tesla's still going well. Their deliveries in China for the first 2 months of this year, 131,812 vehicles. So still pretty impressive. That's a 6% decrease from the previous year, but then you've got some other local giants like BYD who are really ramping up their production, so lots of Chinese companies are getting in on the act. Now, this, again, is interesting. We've got the Tesla Shanghai Gigafactory that's mainly making cars for China, but obviously places like Australia, we're getting our cars delivered from China as well. But this is good news overall. Now, if I'm a Tesla shareholder, maybe I'm not that excited about this, but it means that things are happening across the world. The China Passenger Car Association said that there'll be 25% growth in new energy vehicle sales in China this year. That'll be 11 million units for the year. So people that think EVs are dead, well, there's 11 million people that have probably got a little bit of an argument there. And still, Tesla's not going too bad. They'll produce around 450,000 cars this year out of their Shanghai Gigafactory. So that's not a terrible number. But again,
so they're far from giving up.
That's right. And this is what we want. We want Tesla, who have pretty much had it on their own for a number of years, to say, we better pick up our act. How can we improve what we do? And what I'm really keen to see, James, is not just new companies like BYD and Tesla and other companies that we haven't heard of before. I want the traditional manufacturers. I want the car companies that have been there for decades, for a century. I want those car companies to say, we need to get in on this EV act because everyone else is. What can we do to pick up the act? And if they can come on or into the game as well, more pressure on Tesla, more pressure on each other, competition from a consumer perspective, I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Bring it on, I say. And with that, we are all over Red Rover for another week, folks. And my phone's run down to about 3%, and we're risk of cutting out completely here. Our first international tech talk with this week, Matt. What a cracker it was. Perhaps next time, maybe I can be the one with a plane ticket. I'm just saying.
We'll see what we can do for you, James. But look, I've got to go too. I will be absolutely right. I'm not down to 3%, but I've got to get back to the toilet because I can't go for too long without playing with some new feature on those toilets. And I'm in a new motel today, so I want to go and find out what this toilet's got to add to my experience so far.
Well, we'll let Matt have a little bit of alone time. As for today's episode, well, I reckon I'm going to give those new solid-state EV batteries 5 stars. And that Neuralink brain implant, still, I'm only at 1 star. Not sold on that one just yet. Well, thank you for tuning in once again, folks. Tech Talk with Matthew Dickerson is a homegrown podcast brought to you by the wonders of the 21st century technology. And just a little bit of gypsy magic as well. And I'm James Eddie, wishing you good health and fun times for the next 7 days, when we'll catch you again for our next top-notch episode. Cheerio!